Neil, are you in jail?
Hey. Well, like I said, this is my one phone call. I wanted to use it to call into Hot Takedown.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's sports podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin. With me in the studio, it's not Neil the Statman Payne who decided to call in today. Neil, what's your excuse?
Oh, you want to know my excuse? Well, it's tax day, and in honor of that, I decided to kind of stay here and make sure that all of my forms and all of my documents were in order.
That's weird, because I feel like we've known it's tax day for most of the year.
Yeah, pretty lame excuse, both because it's taxes and because you could have seen it coming.
Oh, I could have done it many months before, if not even weeks or days before, and I chose to wait till. And the sad thing is that today shouldn't even be tax day. It should have been 3 days ago, but we got a little break because of federal holidays and this, that, and the other, and I still waited till the last day.
Well,
at least he's owning it.
Yeah, that's true. That other voice you hear, listeners, it's Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist and senior lead of 538's podcast research and development department. Kate, big
when
promotion
did you think of
you.
That one?
Big promotion just now. I was thinking about the podcast you're planning.
Oh, that's
which
true.
Which may be top secret, so we're not allowed to talk about
as
it.
As soon as we can start promoting it on the show, I expect to dedicate minutes at the top of every show to it.
The number of logs that will be rolled for that new podcast will be quite high. Congratulations on your big promotion.
Thank you.
That you're not being compensated for. Kate.
Standard ESPN work right there.
Kate, can I just – I don't think the listeners quite care. You're wearing a wind jacket, a windbreaker. And I've seen other people wear these windbreakers, and they're sort of like flying squirrel windbreakers. like the armpit fabric like doesn't come all the way up to your armpit. It's like got a big drop. And I'm curious why is this the fashion? Is it about like aerodynamism as you run or something?
Speaking of running and breaking records, the reason I have this squirrel like windbreaker is because my girlfriend is sponsored by Under Armour.
Oh wow. Okay.
So I have no. I did not know that it had a weird cut. It was free.
I didn't mean to make you self-conscious.
No. I'm into it now. We will put a picture of this up on 538.com so everybody can judge it.
I think it's
yeah. I'm assuming from the sound of it that like you could like jump off of a tall building or something and then like glide through the air. Like
who's
have you ever
the stat man now, Neil?
Something like that.
That would be
really dope. I feel like.
I'll call. Well, my nickname should be, I guess, Squirrel Woman? I don't know.
I'm so
well,
sorry.
The unkillable squirrel girl is already taken, right?
All right. Let's get to the actual content of today's show, which is not
it's
about
good content.
Kate's fashion choices, but rather, it's about sports. But today, I don't know. We're not doing the playoff series. You know, we're not doing NBA and NHL as main segments. We're going to talk about the NBA a little bit. Not just sick of it. We're storing up. We know we're going to be talking about this stuff for ages. So instead,
and it's like Cavs are beating the Pacers. We knew that would happen. Spurs
well,
beating the
Bulls
Grizzlies. We knew
Celtics.
That would happen.
Yeah, but Portis.
Oh, we're not talking about the NBA,
sorry.
Okay? It was
so
supposed
sorry.
To be just
so
a throwaway
sorry.
Line, and then you drag me into NBA talk.
You're the one who started. All right. Save it for Sig Dig. Instead, we're going to be talking about two things. One is how modern relief pitching is broken in Major League Baseball. Nate Silver, you may have heard of him, will be here to talk about how he's planning to reinvent the save with something called the goose egg. And then for our second segment, we will talk about a little bit about Boston Marathon, but really just use the Boston Marathon as an excuse to talk about running and the limits of performance in running and whether a sub-2-hour marathon is possible, because several companies and organizations think it is, even though no one has quite done it yet. And then for our Sig Dig, we are going to talk about the NBA playoffs. We will particularly talk about whether the Memphis Grizzlies were right to think that they deserved more fouls purely by act of being near the basket in Game 2 of their series against the Spurs. All right. I think that's it. Should we talk about baseball?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, with us in the studio is 538 Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Howdy, Chad.
Howdy. Nate, you are here to explain why modern relief pitching is broken. Should we start with the save? Is that the best place to start?
It's broken because statistics broke it, dude.
Ooh. Because not advanced statistics, but a stat in particular broke it, in your opinion.
The save.
The save. Okay, so why is the save so bad?
Wait, first can I have the origin of the save stat?
So, sports writer Jerome Holtzman.
I love that you just
know Jerome.
You know it. You just knew it.
No, but
is this the only thing Jerome was ever known for?
No, I'm not like anti Jerome.
Who would be?
Because, like, actually, if you read Joe Posnanski had a good piece on the save the other day, and, like, actually, the original rules that for the save were somewhat better, right? Like, to get the three inning save, you had to pitch two innings. So the bar was a little bit higher, but they kept tweaking it, and, like, you know, and making it easier and easier and dumbing it down. It's like save inflation. And so it's time to throw it out now, basically.
And so not just because the stat is bad, but because managers are now managing to it.
Yeah,
right?
So what shocked me is that if you look at what we define as a high leverage appearance, which is basically an appearance where it's anywhere from a tie to you're up two runs in the final three innings, only about 55% of the innings closers pitch are actually in high leverage situations. And they're only pitching 65 innings a year. And so it's like, you know, you're being used so daintily, these right. closers, and they're not using them in the right way. It like can't possibly be the right strategy. And you can't also say, oh, these guys, you know, they're accustomed to it. Well, that might be true, but for years of baseball history, from the 50s through the 80s, early 90s even, relievers were used in a more aggressive way, where they threw more innings, they threw in tied games more, multiple inning appearances. They're still used that way in the postseason now. So, I mean, this is really irrational, and, you know, the goose egg is meant to be a way to fix it.
So, okay, so
the goose egg.
You spent 5,000 words on 538, a brisk and breezy 5,000.
When you say spent 5,000, are there a limited quantity of words available?
It's the internet, guys.
Feels like it sometimes.
Words are free.
So in this opus, you laid out this new stat, and the goal is basically to have managers start to rely on the goose egg rather than on the save to help prioritize their decisions a little differently. So, Nate, what constitutes a goose egg?
So, basically, a goose egg is a scoreless inning in the seventh inning or later in a clutch situation, which means anywhere from a tie to up two runs, with some exceptions if you come in with runners on base. So it's not that different, right? You kind of think, oh, the save is the ninth inning where it's like, you're 1-3 runs ahead. We shift that a little bit because the seventh inning is almost as important as the ninth. And also, it turns out a three-run lead, not a clutch situation. A tie, which you don't get any credit for with saves, definitely is a clutch situation. So, you know, we're kind of removing this window and putting it over where the actual high-leverage situations are.
So I was going to ask that, Nate. So this definition sort of aligns as best as you could with sort of targeting as many high leverage situations as you can and excluding as many of those sort of like cupcake non-high leverage situations that sometimes closers get saved in these days?
Yeah, I mean, there aren't really a lot of cheap gooses, I guess. I mean, there are cases where you can come in with runners on base. And with runners on base, then you can get credit, for example, throwing just one out if there are two runners on. So it's a little bit cheaper. On the other hand, that's a really, really, really high leverage situation. And so giving people a little more credit if they have runners on base. And by the way, we don't give you a goose egg if an inherited run scores. If you're one of those pitchers, you come in and you're like, well, I don't have any earned runs on my record, right? But you allow an inherited runner to score, then it's not a goose egg. It might be a meh. So there are three categories, right? There's the goose egg. There's what I wanted to call the blown goose that was vetoed. It became the broken egg. That's the second category. Then there's the meh.
Well, from having read at least the first third of this opus, to me, the distinguishing characteristic is that I, if I were an amazing relief pitcher, could get multiple goose eggs
multiple.
Within one game.
Yeah, you can get three in a game. In fact, if you pitch extra innings, you can get...
What is that called?
A triple goose?
A golden goose?
An omelet? I don't know.
An omelet.
So, Wade Davis with his fourth omelet of the season.
But my question was for folks who are really into baseball statistics, they could say, like, isn't this just an elevated hold? Like, it's kind of just a hold.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't read the whole article, so maybe this was answered within it.
So, you know, a hold, you can come into the game. I think this is right. You can come into the game with a 3-run lead, give up 2 solo home runs, leave, and you get a hold.
Okay.
I mean, the hold is like the worst statistic imaginable.
Worse than the save.
The hold is worse than the save.
So the idea, I think, is that this is local to leverage, whereas the hold doesn't factor in that. So the idea being you want your best reliever in the game when the stakes are highest. And the hold doesn't take into account stakes. And so that's where the real difference
is.
It's
pretty intuitive, right? If you go and a guy pitches well, he's going to get a goose egg. If he pitches poorly, he'll have a broken egg. And if it's in between, it's a meh. But the point is that you can use this number, and we're talking about this in kind of funny ways, but like, you know, but you can see, for example, that Jess Familia and Andrew Miller had 42 goose eggs last year. So it looks a lot like the save totals, but one of them was used as a fireman. One of them was used as a closer. Addison Reed on the Mets had 39 goose eggs last year. He was a strict setup man, so it kind of equalizes things between different types of pitchers. It also shows that no pitcher right now is being used as effectively as pitchers were in the 70s and 80s. You know,
I wanted to ask about that, Nate. So if managers started managing to the goose egg instead of to the save, that they would end up with a bunch of guys like Andrew Miller, like, you know, the Goose Gossages of yesteryear, right, where you would use them in weird situations that they haven't been used in decades.
Yeah, I mean, our recommendation is you start, first of all, eliminate. You're never going to have your pitcher in the game with a 3-run lead unless there are runners on
base. Your best relief pitcher.
Your best relief pitcher, right. No point in doing that at all. So you replace that with the tied appearances in the ninth. That's the first step, the gateway drug. Then you add 1-run leads in the eighth, which is the next most clutch situation after a 1-run lead in the ninth. Then you can maybe add ties in the eighth. Then you can add maybe in jams in the seventh. It's usually worth it to bring your best pitcher on if you have 2 runners on, say, in the seventh with a 1-run lead, even if you have to remove him later, right? I mean, that's a weird thing about the save is you can pitch great. If you're removed from the game, you're no longer save eligible. That also changed as the rule went along. And so, you know, it's pretty well designed so that you can't kind of trick it, right? If you were trying to maximize the number of gooses that your pitcher got, goose eggs, your strategy would be pretty optimal. Now, you can debate, like, how much to divide them between, you know, there are about 150 possible goose eggs per season per team. So that translates to 150 innings. Although there actually are guys from the 70s and 80s who pitched that many innings, probably not going to see that today. But, you know, but you could manage it if you used your bullpen more effectively. You could use 2 relievers, whereas now these teams want bullpens that go 3 or 4 relief pitchers deep, right? You can basically handle all of the high leverage situations with 2 relievers if you manage them a little bit more smartly.
How is it that the save got bastardized so completely?
My theory is it has to do with Dennis Eckersley and Bobby Thigpen in 1990. That's kind of when we see a turning point when they had these massive save totals. Thigpen had what? Neil, do you know this offhand? Was it 51 or 53 saves or something?
It's in the 50s for sure.
And, you know, Eckersley had 57 saves, I think, right? Which massively broke the record. And then, like, Eckersley, I think, was the AL MVP that year in 1990. I may be making this all up.
No, I think that's right, and that's like such. Even now, I mean, that's such a foreign idea to have a closer be MVP. That maybe that shows that we are kind of moving in a direction where eventually, someday, managers and people in the game would be willing to break with the orthodoxy of the save.
But yeah, I mean, Eckersley had pitched that year 73 innings in 63 appearances, which is kind of roughly how modern closers are used. That hadn't been true even a few years earlier, right? If you made 63 appearances, you probably would have had 90 innings. You're pitching an inning and a half a game. And so it's kind of like, I think managers said, hey, you know, I can be a one-inning reliever, and now I can have this kind of shiny save statistic and ERA. And you just, you know, if you're not actually measuring value and realizing, you know, how much less value you have if you're pitching 1 inning a game instead of 2, it sounds so simple, but, like, there wasn't really a stat to kind of keep track of this. It wasn't rewarded by saves, wasn't rewarded by wins and losses. You know, it used to be that if a pitcher got like 12 or 14 wins in relief, he would be a Cy Young candidate. People would notice that. And then, you know, that stopped when they stopped being used in tied games. So I really do think this is a case where people are managing to a statistic. I don't think it's just coincidental.
Which managers are most likely to start, or which managers are already doing this best of trying to be efficient with their reliever usage? Is Francona the obvious example, or is Miller actually so good, and so that's what changes that dynamic?
I think you could argue that. I think Miller is the only, people will write me and say I can think of one or two other examples, right? But Miller, I think, is the only pitcher in baseball right now who's kind of deliberately being used in this way, and the and is important, and who is almost for sure the best relief pitcher on his team, although the Indians have a deep bullpen. You know, I think you see guys now who they'll be used more in this way because they're converted starters who are maybe the second or third best pitcher, so they'll kind of stay in the game and stuff like that. But we're talking about taking your best reliever and deliberately using him, certainly in the eighth inning, sometimes in the seventh inning, definitely using him in tied games, right? Multi-inning appearances. I don't know. Like, something about me thinks this kind of will change. It's a pretty massive advantage, potentially. I think it's problematic because you have to have your whole bullpen coordinate around it. So, you know, if you have Andrew Miller, then everyone else in the Indians has to work around that usage pattern. But so there's kind of like another equilibrium, right, where, you know, you use a guy for two innings at a time all the time and kind of ride at the hot hand a little bit. You know, in the National League in particular, you can manage your pitchers in a way that you avoid having your pitcher hitting. Obviously, it's going to happen anyway for the most part, right? But you can work around that in different ways. I mean, you know, this sounds stupid, but like when I play like baseball video games, like that's how I use my bullpen, right?
You've channeled the goose even in your virtual life.
Yeah, a couple of innings at a, you know, I like stockpiling two or three good relievers and like go a couple of innings at a time, you know. Okay. Yeah.
We won't ask for your PS4 handle.
Okay.
Is there any similar gap in the a defined area of play in any other sport, like, or misdefinition?
It's
probably more
I mean,
than
this
gap.
Is kind of comparable to the two-point conversion stuff, or I should say the fourth down stuff, both really, but especially the fourth down stuff in the NFL, where it's like, yeah, you know, we've always done things a certain way, and except the weird thing about this is that we're not asking teams to, like, progress so much as go back to the future. This is how closers were used for the 70s and 80s, which is when you had certainly the best individual closer seasons of all time, and these guys were pitching 120, 140 innings sometimes, right? And that were incredibly valuable, Goose Gossage or Suter or Guillermo Hernandez, and that totally disappeared. You know, I can't think of a lot of other cases where you had a strategic innovation and then teams regressed from it towards something worse. And so, you know, so when I, you know, emails I've gotten from like baseball traditionalists and stuff, people actually kind of like this idea because that's the way pitchers were brought up, and it turns out that they were right all along.
So I was going to end the segment by asking you, have any general managers or coaches or managers emailed you since the?
I've gotten one or two. You know, people like actually like this idea. I haven't heard from any pitchers though, right? So if there are probably some relievers out there, you know, Houston Street or whatever, probably doesn't like this idea because he can't stretch himself out as much. But you do have the sense that it's going to be a thing where maybe there'll be some. Maybe it's going to be Miller or something, or a pitcher like Miller. Who throws 90 innings in a season and it's just massively valuable, and hopefully there's some way to actually measure that value and have that be appreciated.
We should have printed out a little, like, 10-point laminated sheet for managers to hang up in their bullpen so that the pitchers would get on board. All right. Nate Silver, thanks for coming on and talking about Goose.
Okay, thank you.
Listeners, you can read all about the Goose Egg and its namesake, Goose Gossage, on 538, where you can find Nate's article. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Casper, the mattress company. A great night's sleep can help you have a great day, and with a Casper mattress, you can have both. The Casper mattress was invented with two high-tech foams that give you all the support you need and guarantee that you get the best night's sleep that you have ever had. The mattress ships for free in a box so small you will not believe it holds a mattress. It's easy to get to your bedroom. And Casper lets you try the mattress once it gets to your bedroom for 100 nights in your own home. And that trial is risk-free. And if you don't love it, Casper will come and pick up the mattress and refund you everything that you spent. No questions asked. From its breakthrough design to its packaging to letting you try it for 100 nights, it is no wonder that Casper was named one of Fast Company's 50 most innovative brands of 2017. And you're going to want to sleep on the mattress that you end up picking, not just lie on it in a store. And that's why Casper's trial is such a great feature. So to get Casper and get a great night's sleep every night, go to casper.com/takedown and use code takedown for $50 towards the purchase of your mattress. That's casper.com/takedown. Again, that code is takedown and you're going to get $50 off towards the purchase of your mattress. Casper.com. Terms and conditions apply. Okay, now on to running, something we don't really talk about that often on the show, but the Boston Marathon was earlier this week. Two Kenyans won the marathon in the men's and women's race, and they won it fast, but not as fast as some had been anticipating. Could be that a marathon could be run. In the men's result, Jeffrey Kiry, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, won in 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 37 seconds. And in the women's race, Edna Kiplagat, again, not sure of the pronunciation, won in 2 hours, 21 minutes, and 52 seconds. So here to talk about marathon timing, and in particular, whether a sub-2-hour marathon is possible, we brought on our 538 colleague, Christy Ashwanden. Hi, Christy.
Hi, nice to be back, Chad.
Great to have you back. So, Christy, you write a lot about the intersection of science and sport, and recently people have been talking a lot about whether a sub-2-hour marathon is possible. Presumably this would be on the men's side of things. Before we get to whether that's possible, let's start with the fastest marathon that has been run. It's faster than what I just said for Boston, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. The current world record is 2:02:57, and that is held by Dennis Kimeto from Kenya.
Okay, and so 2:02:57, it both sounds like 3 minutes shouldn't be hard, but of course, as we talk about on the show quite often, when you're at the edge of human performance, 3 minutes is like a huge amount to make up.
Yeah, someone who's good with math, how many fewer seconds per mile is that?
Like, yeah, I mean, it's huge. Let's just say that the current record, so Kimeto was the first to break the 2:03 mark, which I just want to say that is smoking fast. Like that works out. So the current world record works out to 4:41 per mile.
Oh,
and I can venture to guess that none of us here on the podcast today can run 1 mile in that time.
I would like to add in that I have attempted to run an entire 200 meters at that speed and I can't do it.
Right. And so to go under 2 hours, you actually have to drop that. So to go, that means going from 4:41 per mile to a little bit less than 4:35 per mile. So again, this is a super fast pace for 1 mile, and we're talking 26.2.
Neil, what's your mile?
You don't want to know anymore. I used to be able to run like 8, you know, there's a 9-minute mile back in the day. It wasn't pretty.
But then you started working 538 and haven't moved exercise yeah. since. All right, so what's it going to take then, Christy, to get those 6 seconds per mile shaved off or just to get to the sub-2 in general? You know, is this something where – is it science? Is it ability? Is it equipment? Well, you know, how are we going to get to that new frontier?
Yeah, well, if you read our chat last week about this,
on
I had a couple of really smart other science running geeks on to discuss this. And really, this was the question that we were talking about, you know, is science going to be the thing that's going to change this? And so here I should probably mention that right now there are three big projects underway that are trying to crack the 2-hour mark. So two of them are sponsored by shoe companies, not surprisingly. One is by Nike, the other is Adidas. And then there's this other project that's run by some academics. So all three of these projects are trying to get under sub 2 hours. And so the question then is, how are they trying to do it? And they're all sort of using similar tactics. Of course, you know, Nike is really focused on the shoe that they have. It's sort of got a spring, and this, you know, this is all sort of like proprietary technology. It's been very talked about. We haven't seen one up close. Nike has given a couple of journalists sort of extra access, but these aren't out on the market yet. You can't go buy them. But supposedly the Nike shoe increases efficiency by about 4%, which is huge. Okay. So the marathon time that we're looking at here to drop down below 2 hours, we're talking about 2.5% faster. With that said, you know, the sort of cynical view here is that this is just a gimmick to try and sell shoes, right?
Yeah, Christy, I wanted to ask about, like, is this all just a technological improvement at this point, or are there other things like about technique or kind of course planning that could help the people, you know, the humans that are running the race actually improve their times without having to resort to, you know, weird technological things?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, you know, one thing about running is that it's sort of one of the least technological sports there is. I mean, it's really just sort of pure athleticism, right? And so most of the advances that have been made have really been made in terms of training and things like that. There hasn't been a lot of technology that has changed things, unlike other sports. But there are a few things that people are looking at that could actually make a difference. So one of them is just having the right kind of course, right? And the ideal course here would be one that's flat and that also doesn't have a lot of turns. But here it's important to point out that the IAAF, which is the governing body of track and field, actually has a few qualifications. So if you want this sub 2 hour marathon to be legal, to be an official world record, the course can't be point to point. This is to avoid having a tailwind help you out. There's a limit to how much downhill it can have. So it basically needs to be flat, or, you know, a little bit hilly would be okay too. That's not going to be what breaks the record though. But then the other thing, and this is something I wrote about in terms of the Olympics last summer, is that it needs to be cool. In fact, almost cold. There's been some research looking into this, and sort of the ideal temperature seems to be about 39 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is why, you know, we're not seeing really fast marathons at the Olympics, because they're held sort of at the wrong time of year and in too hot conditions.
When we think of breaking barriers on the running side, we all go to Roger Bannister breaking the 4 minute mile. I'm wondering, what lessons are there to draw from that record breaking moment? Was it, because I know we being like the sports community, was pursuing a sub 4 minute mile. So how did they get there? Was it the unique combination of like an individual talent along with whatever technological advancements they could make at that time, along with what you're saying? Like, what lessons can we draw from Bannister breaking 4 minutes?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting contrast, actually. So Roger Bannister was a medical student at the time. He was doing a lot of his training on his lunch hour, actually. And this was just sort of, you know, sheer running. He was going out there and gutting it out. And that's how he did it. I mean, some of his training methods aren't exactly what people would use today. He would go out and just sort of run really hard every day, which is a little bit different than how people train now. But it really was just about sort of the athleticism of the sport. Whereas these three projects that are underway right now are really trying to use science to crack the problem. And so that's kind of where the question comes in. You know, is science really going to be what does it? I'm a science writer, I'm a fan of science, but there are limits to sort of the things that it can do. And a lot of people are pretty skeptical that, you know, it's going to be a special sports drink or, you know, something like that that's going to make the difference here.
Yeah, because I assume we just have to wait for the right athlete to come along. Because, well, one more follow-up question, because Christy, when you said that the shoe that Nike is attempting to build could shave off 4%. I guess I assumed you meant 4% off the previous shoe's performance as opposed to 4% off the overall result of the marathon, because that just seems like such a lofty percentage.
Yeah, and I think we need to be, that number is suspect, right? That's what Nike's telling us about the shoe. I don't think that we have any, you know, really truly independent data on that yet. And I'll just mention here that it's a little bit controversial, right? You know, running isn't a very technological sport, and there's been sort of some concerns among the running community about whether, you know, a shoe like this, if it truly can make a 4% difference, should such a shoe be legal, particularly if it's just, you know, these few sponsored by Nike athletes who have access to it. You know, that doesn't seem very fair. Track and field does have a few rules about this. It's not clear right now sort of, you know, where this will fall down in the end. But it's something that's being talked about a lot.
So when Nike says 4% improvement, do they mean overall to a marathoner's time? I'm not saying that whether or not that is inflated or not. Is that what they're positing?
Not precisely. So they're talking about a 4% increase in efficiency. And so whether or not that translates into 4% better time is not clear. There have been some tests looking at shoe efficiency and how shoes affect it that suggest that it's possible that it could translate like that, but it's not a given. And I just have to say here too that you cannot underestimate the difficulty of the marathon. And by the difficulty, I'm talking about not just that it's a hard event, but that it's an extremely difficult event to sort of get exactly right. So it's pretty, you know, straightforward to finish a marathon, but to run a perfect race is really, really, really hard. It's just something, I mean, on a regular basis, you'll have a marathon starting with some of the world's top runners. And by the end of the race, you know, a lot of them will have fallen off. They aren't always running, you know, paces or finishing times that are close to their previous times. I mean, it's just a really, really difficult. I mean, again, this gets back to you're going, 440 miles. That's really fast for a long time. And if it's a race that's strategic and tactical too, that factors in as well.
So, Christy, real quick, I just want to point out that this is reminding me of the Speedo controversy in swimming, when all the world records were set. What was that in Sydney or something like that? And it was part of the reason why was because they were wearing swimsuits that had a new type of fiber, and the water friction was different on them, and whatever else. And then the body and the swimming body, I believe, and I'm not sure the full
Fina.
Yes. They outlawed the swimsuits, and you were talking about this a little bit with the shoes about whether it would be legal or not. But it does seem like, regardless of whether it's legal, you know, is a record if technology is what got us there as opposed to ability? And I'm not sure. That's a hard one for me to answer. And maybe it's naive to think that technology isn't involved in records, because technology happens in training too, of course. And that's one of the reasons that people are getting faster and faster, and nutrition and things like that. And so, in my mind, the idea of a shoe making someone 4% faster feels like it shouldn't be allowed and shouldn't be legal. But then shouldn't I think that about all the other little mini things that go in as people build up for the race?
Yeah, I mean, it really gets to the core issue of what is sport and why do we watch it, right? Are we watching, you know, for the human performance and human excellence, or, you know, are we looking for technological advances? And to what extent should the two be combined, and is it okay? And I don't think that there are straightforward answers here. You know, on the one hand, I'm sort of inclined to say, hey, if everyone has access to the shoes and they're just shoes and we're already using shoes, it's, you know, not some new invention, like by all means, let's use them. But on the other hand, you know, then you go back and look at previous records and you can't really compare them. But, you know, there are a lot of other sports where the equipment has changed, and so records and other things change as well. So, you know, it's pretty soon that you find yourself down this rabbit hole of sort of figuring out what exactly should we be using as the criteria.
You know, we talk a lot about the technological things that these teams are doing, but aren't they also doing things with, like, sports drinks and kind of some stuff that might suggest that I know there's been some research in the past that some of this is just almost like a placebo effect, where, like, if you mentally feel like you're having some kind of boost to your performance and you have this, like, very arbitrary numerical goal in mind, that it actually does kind of help you push toward that barrier, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, the placebo effect is really strong, particularly in sport. And there are a lot of things that athletes do that are probably placebos. I'm pretty skeptical that the sports drink that the Sub-2 project has been working on is going to be magical. On the other hand, if it makes runners feel like they have an advantage, that's worth a lot. And there's also sort of the psychological component, like you say, of feeling like you have all of the support and you have sort of all your ducks in a row. Really, a lot of this is going to come down to confidence, because breaking the record is going to require holding this very fast pace for a long time, 26.2 miles. And so, you know, if you get halfway through or 20 miles into the race and have a lapse of confidence, you know, it's not going to take much for everything to sort of fall apart, the wheels to come off. So, yeah, I think that's a great, great point, Neil.
All right, Christy. That was delightful. Thanks for chatting.
Nice to talk to you guys.
Talk to you soon. Okay, now on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to us, I'm going to deliver this week's. But before we get to it, let's hear from Memphis Grizzlies coach David Fizdale after the Grizzlies' loss in Game 2 of the first round of the NBA playoffs.
We don't get the respect that these guys deserve because Mike Conley doesn't go crazy. He has class, and he just plays the game. But I'm not going to let them treat us that way. You know, I know Pop's got pedigree, and I'm a young rookie, but they're not going to rook us. That's unacceptable. That was unprofessional. My guys dug in that game and earned the right to be in that game, and they did not even give us a chance. Take that for data.
My favorite part comes at the end.
Data.
Not data. You're data, not data.
I'm a data person.
Data. I don't know what I am. I think I go back and forth. Maybe I code switch on data and data. All right. Our colleague, Kyle Wagner, looked into whether Fizdale had basically a rightful complaint and whether or not you could figure out a way to see whether or not a game was called well or not based on the disparity in free throws that were given to each team. So on Monday night, the Grizzlies shot 25.6% of their shots from within 3 feet of the basket. And you'd assume that shooting that close leads to more free throws because you're fouled down low, and there is a correlation between the two based on historical season data. And so 25% of their shots from within 3 feet and a free throw rate of 183. So that's the number of free throws that were given relative to the number of field goals attempted. Free throws attempts versus field goal attempts. So 183. That is far lower than any team averaged during the season, suggesting that maybe the Fizdale was right, especially given how many the Spurs were given relative to the Grizzlies. But then it gets a little complicated because one game is obviously not a season, so there are other games in which there's that kind of disparity. And then also the Grizzlies, interestingly, had the biggest disparity between the number of free throws, the free throw rate of given to them, or mm-hmm. the one that they had, versus their opponent during the season. So
they shot far fewer free throws during the season than their opponents.
Given how many field goals they attempted, correct. So their free throw rates was much smaller than their opponents because they hacked a lot.
Right.
And so
they're very physical
on defense. Yes, and so their opponents had a high free throw rate. The Spurs, meanwhile, were in the top third of the league on that disparity. And so it could just be the mix of these teams, that the way the Grizzlies shoot down low isn't super physical. Maybe it's particularly guard oriented, and maybe they do a lot of pivoting instead of a lot of flying to the rim. And the Spurs maybe and the Grizzlies foul. Yeah, and the Grizzlies foul a lot. So now I don't know what to think about Fizdale's rant, which was a great rant.
I think there's two ways to think about it. One is just as a basketball observer watching that game, regardless of seeing the numbers, I thought the Grizzlies weren't getting calls. But if you put on your historical NBA, I've watched, at this point 20 years of NBA, I understand all of the variables at play, like Popovich and the Spurs and establishing your credentials within the NBA and refereeing to stars and believing that that's a thing. And then I start to think, well, Fizdale's right, but in the context of the NBA, I understand why the game was called that way. And so in the end, I guess I land in yeah, he's right. He's right that a casual observer would be the Grizzlies didn't get a lot of calls, but he's not right. And this is how the NBA operates.
But is there something wrong with that?
If we're here to argue the morality of that, I would say no, because the NBA is so driven by its stars and its teams and its coaches, meaning the star teams, that I've come to expect that if you're a referee and you show up for 82 games and you watch certain guys with the ball at the rates that they have the ball, you get to know them better and you notice more nuances in what they're doing. That this is the most charitable description of what might happen within a referee's mind, other than just labeling preferential treatment to stars. I'm down with all that.
Yeah, I think it also goes the other way, right? Teams can sort of scout referees and kind of know the temperaments and the styles in which, what they can and can't get away with. If you go back to the Jordan Rules, great book about the 1991 Bulls, all the players talked about throughout that whole book was about who's refereeing the game tonight. Oh, well, we got screwed because we got this guy or this other guy. And it was all about because of different, you know, some referees would let you play, some wouldn't. And that was almost like as much of an obsession for the players as scouting their actual opponents in terms of the other team.
Well, I guess it really changes the way you play and, you know, what you try and do on the court. All right. So I think, to me, Fizdale's rant sort of fizzled once I knew the numbers.
Really?
Yeah. I just wanted to say Fizdale.
Did you watch the game?
No. I got the numbers, Kate. Come on.
I got the numbers. All I need is the numbers, yo.
All right. I'm going to get out of this.
Spoken like a true 538er.
Yeah. I'm going to move on very quickly because I realize Kate caught me in not quite a lie, but at least ignorance, which is quite often on the show. Kate Fagan, thanks for talking about sports.
And my other name?
Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist and senior lead of 538 Podcast Research and Development. Thank you for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne, get well soon from your tax your tax-induced days.
Yes, my tax exile, I think that'll end tomorrow since I was able to successfully file.
Excellent. All right. Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast's referee is Jody Abergan. Production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada, per usual. An excellent job in the booth. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. All spelled out. We would love to hear what you think. We are on your favorite podcasting app on iTunes as well. Subscribe to iTunes.com/538. While you're there, leave a review, leave a rating. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.